Welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. As many Americans call for an end to the war in Afghanistan, the fighting and the dying rage on. We are in a complicated war in a complicated region of the world where our allies and our enemies tend to change constantly. On today's show, I'll be visiting with the man the late Christopher Hitchens called Pakistan's best and bravest reporter, Ahmed Rashid. Rashid has a new book out, Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. He's written widely about the region and is considered the go-to expert for individuals, news outlets, and governments as we try to sort out events in this confusing and dangerous neighborhood. My guest today is author and reporter Ahmed Rashid. Mr. Rashid has been the Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia correspondent for the Daily Telegraph for more than 20 years and a correspondent for Far Eastern Economic Review. He also writes for the Wall Street Journal, The Nation, Daily Times in Pakistan, and academic journals. He appears regularly on international TV and radio networks such as CNN, NPR, and BBC World. Mr. Rashid is a prolific writer, and his books include Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil and Fundamentalism in Central Asia, Jihad, The Resurgence of Central Asia, and Descent into Chaos. His most recent book is Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Ahmed Rashid, welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show.
Thank you so much.
It's so nice to have you here. Whenever I have an author, I ask the same question, which is, why write this book and why write it now?
Well, I think the inspiration to write this book was really the young people of Pakistan, who are incredibly confused, concerned, worried about the future of their country, and have, as I described, for the last 20 years, have been given a raw deal by the rulers, both military and civilian, in that the narrative that has been put out about Pakistan, where it is internationally, economically, politically, is really a false narrative. And I'm trying to correct the imbalance and trying to give young people and people outside Pakistan a better vision of, you know, what has gone wrong with the country, why we're in such a mess, and the way out of that. And I think that, you know, the main thrust is to say that since the end of the Cold War in 1989, Pakistan has carried out none of the essential reforms and changes that most other countries in the world carried out. We still support Islamic fundamentalists on our soil to carry out foreign policy vis-a-vis India or Afghanistan. We passed globalization passed us by. We never took notice of it. We haven't carried out any economic reforms for 25 years. We've not raised additional revenues at all. And in the social sector, education, health, energy, all these things are totally stagnant. So, the theme is to show how the last 20 years have actually been wasted and how course correction is seriously needed if Pakistan is to prevent falling off the brink.
Do you feel like the young people are listening? In other words, is this an audience that is searching? And I guess I would draw the parallel to the young people in Egypt and in Yemen and et cetera. Arab Spring. Are you hoping that the same sort of feelings would be generated in Pakistan?
Well, you know, I think the feelings are very much similar to that, and people are looking for change, and people don't want their former political leaders, they want new political leaders. But it must be said that if there's an Arab Spring in Pakistan, it's more than likely that the Arab Spring will be led by the extremists and fundamentalists, because they are the most organized force in the country. Unlike in the Middle East, where, of course, the fundamentalist Islamists had been suppressed by dictatorship, whether it was in Egypt or Tunisia or Libya, for decades. I mean, in Egypt, almost 40 years. In Pakistan, the Islamists have had the support of the state. They've had the support of the military and the intelligence services. And that has strengthened them immeasurably. And I think people are very wary of saying, you know, come into the streets, there'll be an Arab Spring, there'll be a liberal democratic kind of change that will occur. Change is badly needed, but I don't think it's going to take the shape and form of an Arab Spring, simply because the leadership of that movement would be very detrimental to Pakistan.
I'm going to come back to that a little later, but before we go there, I want to ask you about the U.S. as an audience for this book, both everyday Americans who may have a chance to read it, and listeners, the name of the book is Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan and Afghanistan. I'm talking today with the author, Ahmed Rashid. As everyday Americans read this, as well as people in decision-making positions, what do you hope that people on this side of the Atlantic glean from this book?
Well, I hope, I mean, the book covers both Afghanistan and Pakistan, of course, and and U.S. policy towards both. I think U.S. policy towards both Afghanistan and Pakistan are in a terrible state right now. I don't think the U.S. really knows what to do in Afghanistan, even though it wants to pull out by 2014. And likewise with Pakistan, the relations have deteriorated to the point where for the last 5 months there's hardly been any discussion between the two sides. So I hope that this book provides some kind of answers as to how to get back on track with both Afghanistan, how to effect a proper withdrawal, and bring, which will also bring peace to Afghanistan, and how to deal with Pakistan in the meantime. You know, these are immensely difficult problems, but I think the Americans have contributed to the mess up because there have been these conflicting policies in the Obama administration between the State Department and the military and the CIA, and we have not, in the first term at least, been able to see a one-dimensional, a strategic U.S. policy which is being able to deal with all the multitude of problems that it faces on the front in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Now, you mentioned the Obama administration. Do you feel like there was some sort of cohesive policy and objective under the Bush administration relative to Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, no. I mean, the Bush administration made far bigger mistakes. The primary mistake for them was not to acknowledge the power and the strength of the Taliban. They had a one-dimensional policy, which was to go after al-Qaeda. They did not consider the Taliban as a real threat. And in fact, the problem we are facing now in both countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan, you know, are the Taliban. And the second very big mistake, of course, that the Bush administration made was to go to war in Iraq. If there had been a focus on Afghanistan, and if the kind of money and men and material that had gone to Iraq had been deployed in Afghanistan, I don't think we would have ever seen the resurgence of the Taliban in 2003. We wouldn't have seen this deterioration in Pakistan. I think, you know, all the problems would have been far less than they are now. The fact is that for 6-7 years after 2001, the U.S. took its eye off the ball of Afghanistan, refused to put in the resources that were necessary because of Iraq.
Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show, and today I'm talking with Ahmed Rashid. We're talking about Afghanistan, Pakistan, and relations with the United States, and he is an author and reporter. His most recent book is Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. I want to go back to this idea that the U.S. made strategic decisions on where to allocate resources. There's sort of a conventional wisdom out there that things never turn out well in Afghanistan for other countries, whether you're the British or the Soviets or the Americans. This just isn't a region where an outside force can have much impact. Are you suggesting that maybe that sort of conventional wisdom really isn't very wise and that this could have been managed in a way to produce positive outcomes?
Oh, I think this was an entirely different scenario. I mean, you know, certainly, you know, the Afghans don't like to be invaded, and they're very proud.
Who does? Yeah.
Who does? And they're very proud and defiant and nation. But the point was that, you know, we should remember. I mean, just go back to 2001. I mean, the Americans were welcomed by 95% of the Afghan population, and that welcome was really not due to the fact that they were being liberated and they were getting freedom or anything like that. It was to do with the fact that they expected the Americans to change their lives, to improve their lives, to bring in, you know, economic reform and the kind of starvation levels that the Afghan people had faced under the Taliban regime in the 1990s would change and improve, and people would have jobs and schools and all the rest of it. And that never really happened. And, you know, even today, I mean, one of my sort of big arguments in this book is that even today there is still no self-sustaining Afghan economy. The Americans have not been able to build an Afghan economy which would outlast their withdrawal. So, for example, today we've got tens of thousands of Afghans who are employed by U.S. and NATO forces. But, you know, once these forces leave in 2014, all these Afghans are going to be out of a job. So the real issue was that I think there was a golden opportunity back then in 2001 to have, even later, before the insurgency restarted, there was a golden opportunity to improve the conditions of the country with actually very little money. I mean, I remember sitting down with people in Washington in the beginning of 2002 and literally working out on the back of an envelope the figure of $5 billion a year for 10 years. That kind of money, which was peanuts at the time, you know, could have transformed the Afghan economy. Instead, we didn't see anywhere, we didn't even see $1 billion for the first two, three years of aid coming to the civilian.
A lot of the coverage that was pushed here in the United States, both Iraq and Afghanistan, but particularly in Afghanistan, is that the United States was building schools. They were building community centers. They were putting bricks and mortar on the ground in a way that was supposed to change the circumstances of everyday Afghans. Did any of that happen, or did what happened turn out to be too little too late? Sort of evaluate what we've done in the sort of nation building and human aid kinds of situations.
Something certainly happened. I mean, schools without a doubt. I mean, there are now 8 million children in school in Afghanistan, not under very good conditions, meaning that, you know, there may not be furniture, there may not be a blackboard, there may be no paper to write on, but there are schools and teachers. And healthcare has improved dramatically. So clearly, I mean, you know, some things have improved. But when we look at the economy, we look at the infrastructure, we look at Afghanistan is a rural country. We look at investment in agriculture, which could have prevented so many things, such as, for example, a resurgence in growing poppy, which of course produces heroin. Or so you know, these things are certainly lacking. So. Much of the healthcare and school building, which has been a success story, was actually largely carried out by the Europeans under NATO. The Americans certainly contributed to that, but where we just don't have anything is a sustainable economy. And I often give the example that, you know, I was wandering around as a young man in Afghanistan in the late 70s, before the communists came, and you know, Afghanistan was a very, very poor country, poorer than Pakistan, my own country. But the economy was sufficient to feed the people. You know, nobody was starving. There was enough food to go around, and there was a small surplus to export of fruits and vegetables and stuff like that. And they did all right, you know. But the we haven't even been able to, you know, after 10 years of this war, we haven't been able to rebuild even that self-sufficient food economy. Large parts of Afghanistan are suffering from acute malnutrition because, you know, they're not growing the food they should.
Today I am talking with author and reporter Ahmed Rashid. He is a well-known author. He is a well-known reporter. He publishes in a number of international newspapers and international columns. He has written a book, The Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. We're talking a little bit about sort of the issue on the ground in Afghanistan. But Ahmed, I want to turn to sort of a larger issue, which is U.S. comes into Afghanistan after 9/11. We have a portfolio. We're there to deal with Al-Qaeda, with the training camps. And the hope is, as you said, on the part of the Afghani people, that their lives are going to change for the better. part of what we believe when we go into Afghanistan is that we have a friend in Pakistan, and that our ally, our friend, Pakistan, is equally committed to rooting out Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, decreasing opportunities for terrorism, and it essentially joins us in our efforts and aims in Afghanistan. Was that true at the time?
Yes, it was true at the time, because the American objective was solely what President Bush told Pakistan's military ruler, President Musharraf, was that help us root out Al-Qaeda from Pakistan and Afghanistan. And Musharraf certainly obliged. The army, the ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence of Pakistan, they did root out Al-Qaeda. They caught and killed more than 500 members of Al-Qaeda, handed them over to the Americans. A lot of the population of Guantanamo has been put there by the Pakistanis. What did not happen was that the Pakistanis had kept the remnants of the leadership of the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, and given them sanctuary in Pakistan.
Why did they do that?
Well, they primarily did that for a number of reasons. First of all, they didn't like the government that had come into power in Kabul, because they considered that government made up of what was called the Northern Alliance, in other words, those who'd fought against the Taliban and who had links to India and Iran, Pakistan's main rivals in the region.
Right.
So remember, Pakistan was on the losing side in the war in 2001, because Pakistan had backed the Taliban. And only after 9/11 did Pakistan do this U-turn and then promise the U.S. that it would not support the Taliban anymore, but would support the U.S., give it bases, and help defeat the Taliban. But the moment they were defeated, Pakistan took them in, gave them refuge. And so primarily because they didn't like the government, but also because Pakistan felt that maybe the Americans will leave. And the speculation was certainly when the Iraq adventure came up by Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz that, you know, U.S. forces will now go into Iraq, the Pakistanis were convinced that the Americans would leave, and so it was better that the Taliban at least were friendly to Pakistan. It was better that we keep the Taliban as a kind of reserve force, proxy force, in case the Americans leave. And the third reason was simply India, Pakistan's big rival. India had moved back into Afghanistan in a big way, and Pakistan was very fearful of that. So now for the army, there was a rationale. But, of course, this rationale starts unraveling in 2005, 2006, when the Americans start focusing on the Taliban and telling the Pakistanis, you know, what are you doing supporting the Taliban and allowing the Taliban refuge on your soil? Please end this refuge so that, you know, Afghanistan can go back to peace. And that's when the conflict starts between Pakistan and the Americans, because the Pakistanis refuse to do so.
Now, the support for the Taliban certainly was official in the sense that upper echelon government officials had this as a policy. On the street in Pakistan, was there sympathy for the Taliban?
Well, increasingly there was. Initially there wasn't. Increasingly there was, because first of all, Pakistanis disliked the war in Iraq immensely. There was a lot of opposition, political opposition, by not just fundamentalists, but by many young people across the whole Muslim world to the U.S. attack on Iraq. And that, you know, what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years has been a very steady buildup of anti-Americanism in Pakistan. And that's what I'm trying to deal with in my book. I'm trying to say, you know, the naive narrative on the street is that everything that's gone wrong in Pakistan and all the present violence and everything that's gone wrong in Afghanistan is all due to the Americans. If the Americans were to leave Afghanistan, everything would fall back into place and we'd all be fine. Well, that's a completely false narrative, because, yes, the Americans are to blame for a lot of things that have gone wrong, but, you know, things are now deteriorating so fast in Afghanistan and Pakistan because of internal contradictions, not because of the Americans. And we have to recognize those internal contradictions and deal with them. And that's what both Afghans and Pakistanis tend not to do. It's much easier to blame India, to blame America, to blame some conspiracy theory than to really look at the reality of the situation.
This is The Lynn Rivers Show, and today I am talking with author and reporter Ahmed Rashid. We're talking about about Afghanistan, Pakistan, the United States. He has a new book out that is named Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. You mentioned that people were unhappy or Pakistan was unhappy with the government in Afghanistan. Are you talking about the Karzai government, and what were the problems there?
Well, again, you know, there have been long-running disputes between the Karzai government and Pakistan. First of all, the first president who was dealing with him, Musharraf, had a very, very poor relationship with him and fought with him constantly. And, you know, the one of the problems with Pakistan is that because it's been playing this big daddy role in Afghanistan for the last 30 years, first supporting the Afghan Mujahideen against the Soviets, giving sanctuary to the Afghan Mujahideen, getting the CIA to help the Afghan Mujahideen, and then getting involved with the Taliban, Afghans have grown to resent Pakistan's role enormously. And but at the same time, Pakistan has actually intensified its role in playing a big daddy role in Afghanistan. And so people, you know, in Pakistan somehow expect the Afghans to fall in line with Pakistan's wishes when a lot of the time they won't. So, for example, one reason why the Taliban are talking to the Americans right now is there are many reasons for that, but one of the reasons is that the Taliban actually want to break free from Pakistan. And they feel completely hemmed in. They feel manipulated, micromanaged. They want to go back to Afghanistan as free citizens and stop being, coming under the sort of tutelage of Pakistan. So, again, this is a problem we don't recognize. The constant narrative in Pakistan is, we've done so much for the Afghans, they should be eternally grateful to us. Well, at the moment, Afghans think that by helping, supporting the Taliban, Pakistan is doing a great disservice to Afghanistan. And we should, recognize the truth rather than giving out this false narrative to the Pakistani people.
Now, do you think that this situation is exacerbated by sort of the historical players here, Musharraf, Karzai in Afghanistan? I mean, would things have changed if Benazir Bhutto had become prime minister again? I mean, could players have been moved around in a way that would have, if not protected against this situation, certainly lessened it?
Oh, I think so, certainly. As far as Pakistan is concerned, if Benazir Bhutto has been in power, I don't think she would have allowed the military to have so much influence as it does now over strategic policy. I think she would have made friends with India. She would have made friends with Afghanistan. She would have ended the support for the Taliban. I don't think she would have tolerated this at all. Unfortunately, her husband, who's now president, is a very, strategically speaking, is a very weak figure. He's a wily politician who survived all these years, the last 4 or 5 years, but strategically, he's been very cowed by the military, and the military has now become, very important. Likewise in Afghanistan, I mean, there was enormous hope placed on Karzai. Karzai just failed to deliver, and unfortunately, he's had some very good people around him, but he's not been able to tolerate competence. He sacked all the most competent people he's had as his advisors or in his cabinet or in his government. And if you, as a leader, don't recognize competence and realize that, you need more competent people, perhaps even more intelligent people than yourself, in order to govern and promote policies and carry out policies, that's a deep flaw. And Karzai certainly suffers from that flaw. He suffers from a kind of inferiority complex where he feels that anybody who's cleverer than me shouldn't be advising.
It's a threat. Yeah. Well, now you're talking about the Taliban negotiating. They want to go back to Afghanistan as free people. They want to come to an agreement, some sort of agreement with the United States. Where does Karzai end up in all of that? Can you have a Karzai government with a role for the Taliban, or is there going to have to be some big blow-up where one side or another succeeds?
Well, Karzai certainly has been very supportive of talks with the Taliban for a long time, because obviously he sees a ceasefire, the end of the war, as something that, you know, would be a great victory for him and would sort of ensure his legacy in Afghan history, that he brought this war to an end and brought the Taliban to the table. So he's been very keen on these talks. But, you know, the problem has been that he's been constantly asking Pakistan, give me the Taliban to talk to so I can talk to them. And publicly, Pakistan has been saying, oh, yes, we want talks between Karzai and the Taliban. We want to encourage this, etc. But the Pakistanis don't allow the Taliban, who are living in Pakistan, and most of the leadership is living in Pakistan, they don't allow the Taliban leaders to meet with Karzai. So he has grown increasingly frustrated, and he's become very untrustworthy, both of the Pakistanis and of the Americans and of NATO.
Do you think that his days are numbered? Once the U.S. leaves, is he going to be able to maintain that position, or is he simply going to become a historical footnote?
Well, you know, I don't think it's as simple as that. We should remember that in 2014, the year of the American withdrawal, there has to be elections in Afghanistan. And Karzai can't stand because he's had two terms in office. He has to allow someone else to stand. Now, there's enormous speculation as to whether he will step down, or whether he'll use the American withdrawal as an excuse to stay on as president. I hope he steps down. I hope there's a new figure, a new face, and there's a kind of reset of the Afghan political scene. That will be hugely beneficial, and that may encourage an end to the war and bring the Taliban quicker into peace negotiations.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm talking today with Ahmed Rashid. We're talking about his new book, Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan and Afghanistan. You're listening to us on 89.1 WEMU. What you talk about, a reset. Do you, as you look at the at sort of the players and the bench, so to speak, in each country, are there young leaders? Are there people that are in a position, have the talent, have the skills, have the support, where they can step forward, both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, and build the kind of change that you're talking about?
Well, again, I mean, this is something I deal with. There have been acute problems in both countries. First, Afghanistan has been at war for 30 years. And, you know, initially, after 2001, many young people, educated people, refugees who'd lived abroad in the West had got university degrees, came back and joined the government and tried to help Karzai in the government. But many of them became disillusioned very fast because of the actions of Karzai himself, and secondly, because of the preponderance of power in the hands of the warlords. These were the militia commanders and leaders who had been fighting in the civil war and who remained very powerful. So really, you know, I mean, after two elections and a third one now in 2014, this should have been the sort of watershed where young people play a larger role in the politics of the country. But unfortunately, we haven't seen that because of the circumstances. In Pakistan, we've had 10 years of military rule under Musharraf. And under military rule, there's a saying in Pakistan, which is that nothing grows under military rule. There's no politics, there's no politicians, there are no political parties. Musharraf had exiled the two main political leaders, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif. Young people don't join politics in the military rule because there are no politics to join, no political parties.